Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and I'm really looking forward to today. Today is going to be just a great podcast because we're going to spend some time in an area that's really been consuming a lot of my off-screen time as I think through things. And it starts like this. I'm 52 years old, and with every passing year, I learn more and more. And once I thought that the answers were all out there somewhere, and it was my job to get and find them, you know, to gather experiences and data and facts, and that this was the path to knowledge. And it was for the life stage I was in. It was a very important part of my life. But now I know that all of the most important discoveries I have yet to make about life are inside of myself. And whether you call this being on a spiritual path or simply maturing in a healthy way, the results are the same. I now look at life completely differently and have learned some important truths. Chief among these is that I am the only one responsible for how I experience the world and my relationships. The only person I can, with 100% certainty, change in a relationship is myself. And I know that whatever torments or blockages a person has in their life can be addressed and healed by that same person looking inside themselves. That, in fact, that's where all of our answers truly lie. Now, taking one step further, if we want the world to be different in some way, the only way we can begin to change it, again with 100% certainty, is by changing ourselves. So today, we're going to back way up and we're going to become philosophical about the world and our place in it, and maybe burrow into that inner space where all the answers lie. And we're going to do this with our very own Peak Prosperity member, Andrew Graves, who most of you know as Treebeard. Yes, our resident philosopher is coming to the podcast format. Welcome, Treebeard, or I'm going to call you Andrew from now on. Welcome, Andrew.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. Glad to be here.
I'm really excited. Okay. So there's only going to be so much time to talk about this. I'm sure we could go on for hours, and we probably will, just not all today. So let's run through this from the outside in. At a lunch meeting today, I was talking with a gentleman about the angst that I witness in people everywhere I go as being rooted in some existential dread, you know, by which I mean a deep-seated feeling that something is just not right, by which I mean our national narrative just doesn't line up very well anymore with either the facts as we can read them, if we choose to, or even our daily experiences. And so, of course, if you think you're on a ship that's headed for a whirlpool, it's hard to feel really good about things, no matter how comfy your life is. So let's leave the convincing aside. Let's begin with a shared belief that Western culture specifically, but maybe humanity generally, is on an unsustainable trajectory. From your perspective, how does that impact us as individuals?
Well, it's an interesting statement that the consciousness that creates the problems is not the kind of consciousness that can solve them. And, you know, like I said a little bit earlier, is that so much of what we've done in the West, as you said initially, was we've done a great job of exploring the external world, but we've done absolutely nothing about exploring the internal world. And if the internal self is disordered, even if you have the right facts and ideas and are doing the right things, you will still just create more disorder without you. If you're not in the right place and don't have the right awareness, then the actions, you know, become and create more disorder. I'm sure we've all met people like that where they're saying all the right things, but you just sort of feel like something is off. So it's really, you know, like you said, it's about changing the way we perceive the world. In a way, the simple ideas are sort of missed because they're so obvious, not because they're complex. So it's sort of going back to base one, looking internally and seeing the world as it is, which is really, as simple as that statement sounds, seeing the world as it is an amazing challenge. Because we're always perceiving the world through our own sort of, maybe not craziness and maybe not the right word, but through our own perception, through our own way of identifying ourselves as a particular person or group and not being able to come into context directly with reality. And yeah. In my mind, sort of Western culture went off rails, you know, back with the Greeks and the whole idea of the shaved cattle of Plato, where you cannot actually get in direct contact with reality, but there's a whole part of our consciousness which is able to perceive reality directly that we've neglected and actually sort of are in Western culture are saying doesn't even exist anymore.
Well, and this is something I call trust yourself, which is really an invocation to ask people to begin to really use all of their sensory apparatus to sort of divine where we're going, because our heads can tell us one thing, right? We have a narrative in our heads that defines our reality for us, and we all have them. I'm not saying I've transcended this by any stretch. I replace one narrative with a different one, and then I have a different sort of a view. So at Peak Prosperity, we've looked at a bunch of facts, and we've come to this new narrative that says, wow, this direction that we are being asked to fully engage with seems to be heading in a direction that looks like it might end badly, or it has risks, or wait a minute, once we start to examine it, is it even taking us there in the style we've been told? Like, are we really happy? Are we really fulfilled? Are we really living to our fullest selves? And I want to talk, though, about this narrative and the importance of narrative. So you wrote recently, I've got a quote here from a comment you'd put, and here it is. It says, as the veneer of American exceptionalism crumbles away, the raw drive for power and control has become more and more apparent. The flimsy propaganda dressing of making the world safe for democracy is disappearing as the years and mountains of evidence build of our brutal foreign policy of assassinations and covert wars and support of brutal dictators and relentless support of extractive economic policy dressed up as free enterprise. The poorly constructed propaganda has always been this shoddy and ridiculous, but it seems we never had the courage to look ourselves in the eye so that we can say what is truly great and beautiful about our country. What you're saying there to me is that we have a narrative that we've been told, and as we, you know, let me talk to you about my American dream narrative, right? You grow up, you learn that we're the greatest country, we have freedom, we have democracy, we have free enterprise, we've got equal justice, she's blind, money has real meaning and value because you have to work hard for it. All these things you can easily now with the internet scratch away at and go, whoops, maybe not all entirely true, but a national narrative, that the way in which we identify ourselves, I've learned, is really, really important. And if you're being asked to engage in a narrative that is frankly not good for you personally, but not good for your children if you happen to have them, or not good for anybody, it's hard to look that square in the eye without it being a very uncomfortable sort of experience.
Right. I think the first step in being able to come what I would call in contact with reality is owning the ugliness that human beings can be. And, you know, and again, this can sound sort of negative, but I think you have to go through the darkness to get through the light. Mm-hmm. But humans as a species can do some really, not just Americans, but as, think of it, the atrocities throughout history and the things that human beings are capable of and what we've done over time. And it's sort of the avoidance and the desire to be good, you know, to be nice, to reject that dark part of ourselves is what keeps us from being able to see reality directly. It's taking ownership of what we are and what we're capable of and owning that darkness that allows us to come in direct contact with reality. And when you do come in direct contact with reality, there is an overwhelming feeling of intense love. And it's not something that you can describe or something that can be discussed in an article, be intellectualized. It's a state of being where you realize where the foundation of the world is. But as long as we're trying to apologize and reject that dark part of ourselves, we are holding ourselves back from experiencing life as it is. And we have all these mechanisms. We have all these ways of describing that and making that difference. So in a way, I sort of pick on America because, not pick on America, but that's what I know. That's the place that I am. Mm-hmm. And by not owning up to, and this is, I guess, there's a lot of pieces here, and it's hard to know where to start, but the key problem really is identification. Anytime we want to try and build the ego, the individual self, through identification, I'm an American. America's a great country. Therefore, by virtue of being part of this group, I am therefore a good person. Or pick your, whether it's a church group or an intellectual group, you went to a certain university, whatever it may be, that identification separates us from that which we love, because you are now dependent upon and using that entity to build the ego in within yourself. And when you do that, when you're dependent on something, you cannot truly love it because you need something back from it. So in order to love America as it is, the first step is admitting and coming in contact with the dark side, which allows you to see it for what it is. Then the separation between the self and the beloved or the observed disappears, and contact begins and love just flows organically as a part of that experiential process. So it's like the thing that we avoid, the thing we say, no, not that, is the thing that we need the most. If we can have the courage just to own all of it, our, not only the darkness of being an American, but the darkness of being a human being and all that entails, once we own that, then, you know, all kinds of possibilities come into play.
Let me, I totally agree, and let me put a personal flavor on that. You know, one of my formerly favorite pastimes, and I got to be honest, one that still occupies me from time to time, is blaming others. And for instance, I see bankers, right, and what's happening in the whole banking industry, and I look at that, and
right.
I will say, wow, that's really evil, and it's greedy, and this really upsets me. Ask my wife. It still does. And I'll carry that until I realize that the very fact that I'm responding that way emotionally means I've identified with them, which means to go one layer deeper, it means that I would be doing, if I'm honest, I would be doing exactly the same things as those evil, greedy bankers if I was inserted into their circumstances, which means that whatever it is that I find that really upsets me about the human condition is something that exists inside of me. It's part
right.
of me.
Exactly.
And once I can get to that point, I get to this, I can start to begin to get that separation and that compassion of saying, oh, look, they're not evil, greedy. They are just, they are like everybody. They are doing the best they can. And I can maybe cast judgment. And I'll say, and this is maybe not the ideal operating circumstances we should be in right now. How do we shift that? Right. But you're saying the first step is to just have that awareness that there's nothing happening out there that's any different than what's happening inside.
I mean, think about it. There's this whole issue with the 1%. You've got 1% of the population, which is getting enormously wealthy, and 99%
right.
of the population is getting much poorer. Well, that condition cannot exist unless the 99% are enabling the 1% to do what they're doing.
Right.
So, and the minute you blame somebody else is the minute you give away all your power, because now the people you're blaming are the people who have the responsibility and the power to act. So then you become a victim. The minute you take ownership of the problem, then you also take your power. Power and responsibility and ownership all come together. You can't just selectively say, okay, all the bad stuff in the world is the responsibility of person A, B, C, and D, and all the good stuff in the world is the responsibility of me. And it really is having the courage and the strength to take on that weight and then act in a way that makes a lot of sense.
Andrew, this is, I want to, before we move past that point, because this is really central to the core tenet of peak prosperity in my mind. I always set this up as a this is a trust yourself environment. We're going to start laying out the tools. We're going to start gathering our personal capability to begin to wrestle with the implications, the facts as they exist, looking inside, looking outside, starting to really put these pieces together. But I never wanted to or set myself up to be a guru of any kind because I don't believe in them. I believe that it's each of us has the responsibility to act in ways that are in accordance with what we know to be true. And that can shift over time. But as of today, I think the people at peak prosperity feel that responsibility. They know they've got some important information. They're starting to see the world in ways that other people around them aren't. And the struggle then, the struggle is, how do I really take on the weight of that responsibility? Like at a deep level, that's really the request being made when you come in contact with this world-changing sort of information is, what am I going to do with it? Right? And it becomes your responsibility, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And that is so important. That point about, and I don't know where this idea got into my head, but for so long, it's really about you have to take responsibility for all your own actions. And absolutely, we do have to go out to experts, as it were. But if that expert cannot explain the issue to you in a way that you can understand and internalize and then act upon it, that person is not really an expert at all. Mm-hmm. Because we have to be able to trust their own ability to perceive reality. And if you can't get to the point where you can internalize it, well, then don't play in that field. If you can't have someone explain how the stock market works to you, then don't go in the stock market, because now you are giving away your power and allowing somebody else to make a series of decisions for you that you don't understand. So that is deflating and destroying the sense of your own self-worth and being, and doesn't allow you to act and grow and take responsibility for your own actions. So, you know, there's so much, you know, misinformation and bad information, and people who are posing as experts who are really giving you very bad and poor information, who are now sort of putting people in a position where they have no information upon which to act. And that's one of the great crimes that's going on right now in this world, especially, and it seems, in the United States, the quality of information that's available, and kudos to you, Chris, for what you're doing, of course, is that the quality and amount of information we get from the website from you is just astounding. And what's out there, I mean, you talk to other people, I'm sure many people have had the same kind of experience. You talk to other people, and they just don't have a clue. They just don't have the information to make sort of rational decisions. It's just, you know, it's really astounding.
It is astounding. And the desire to continue to keep those waters muddy is strong. You know, I was one of the only commentators I'm aware of. There were a few, but not that many, who picked up on this whole idea that Janet Yellen basically was blaming the 99% for getting poorer. And you know, I took exception to that because the facts are easy to ascertain. When the Fed prints money, it flows to people who the Fed hands it to. That's not a really difficult concept. But still, you had Janet Yellen out there saying, well, you people, you're not entrepreneurial enough. You're failing to invest in your children sufficiently. And next time, remember to have wealthy parents. But I just thought that was so disconnected from what is easily and obviously verifiable information. The fact that it went unremarked on just shows you how vast that gap is between context and information and how little of that really gets connected in our society, almost by design, I guess. I'm not clear on that, but it's too big of a gap for me to just say, wow, I guess we just, another major thing that fell through the cracks there, huh?
Right. And I guess I just would like to sort of transcend the whole political thing. I guess on the outset, you know, it is true that by sort of owning the darkness, admitting, again, the whole idea of identification, that you identify and sort of use the group you're within to build your own structure of the individual I or ego, that once that occurs, then it becomes very difficult to see anything objectively. And we have to sort of cut that cord. And if you sort of, okay, you know, the evil that comes with power is sort of a given, that, you know, the United States has had this idea of manifest destiny, and you can go through the horror stories of what we did to the Native Americans, and it's kind of like the assassinations and all that stuff, but it's almost like, well, let's own that, let's admit that how real evil is, and begin to understand, you know, what evil actually is, rather than getting into this whole blame game, and then sort of move on, because sort of getting into these political arguments, to me, can be sort of almost self-destructive and unproductive, because already you sort of tend to what I would call match energies, and you polarize, and then you're sort of shouting at each other, and it really doesn't go anywhere. It's almost like you have to admit, okay, this is, the evil is there, but what is evil? How can people of good intentions, well-educated, with moderate temperaments, how can they go ahead and do these crazy things? That's sort of the question that seems to come up over and over again. Either you see this in the dialogue on the website all the time. Are these people crazy, or are they evil, or are they stupid? And I think what it's about is that there is a way of thinking and perceiving the world that does not allow them, and it goes back to what I said earlier about the consciousness that creates the problem cannot solve the problem. And as long as we keep coming back at them on their terms, in their context, then nothing ever shifts. It just polarizes about a center point which we can't get to. And that center point is what I call connecting to reality through what I would call sort of the authentic self. And so, yes, let's admit that the evil's in the world. Let's not get hung up on the fact that Janet Yellen can be doing enormous evil, even though she may not be aware of that fact, because of the instruments, her cognitive instruments she's using to try and solve the problem. But let's not get hung up there. Let's examine what evil is, how we get past this mindset that is destructive to one that can connect to reality and, you know, connect to the foundation of the world, which really is love. So that, to me, is the important part of the dialogue. And to get caught in the sort of political stuff and the blame game, it becomes unproductive and doesn't really go anywhere.
Oh, it never does. That's why we avoid such belief-based material as much as possible at Peak Prosperity. The thing about Janet Yellen for me is not to say that wow, she must be really manipulative and evil to have said what she said. I honestly, I will tell you, I flat out think that she believes what she said. I think that it's amazing that she has a context that's so fundamentally different from what I think is a easily verifiable context. And those are two separate worldviews. So here we are with lots and lots of powerful people entrenched in spots. And here's something I run into all the time, Andrew. These same people who will be out there trading the bond markets vigorously daily, in the stock market doing their thing, running hedge funds, being the captains of industry, it doesn't matter their station, but especially the people who are very high up, they will play the game because that's the game that they have in front of them. But privately, they'll tell you they're really uncomfortable with where things are going. And how could you not be when the World Wildlife Fund says, hey, we lost half the wildlife in the last 40 years. And somebody else goes, hey, where's all the water going? You know, you see these signs that say, huh, maybe there's something here we should look at. But nobody publicly really knows how to addressed that yet. And so it really gets to me, like, individual consciousness is a difficult thing to wrestle down. But boy, is that just a far cry easier than trying to wrestle down the collective consciousness or unconsciousness, as the case may be. Meaning, you take the Janet Yellens, you take the CEOs, you take the hedge fund operator, and they will continue to do what they do, even though deep down they know they're doing the wrong thing. And that's, you know, picking on captains of industry, but I think there are a lot of people out there living those two lives with a deep sense of, hey, maybe this isn't the right direction for me personally or even for us collectively, and I got to keep doing this. And that tension, that's the angst I talked about at the beginning of all this. That's what I feel more and more palpably. Maybe I'm looking for it, but I'm pretty sure it's building.
Oh, absolutely. And I think what it is that, and I've sort of picked on this a lot in my commentaries, is that there is two sort of, you know, maybe in the popular culture it's called left brain, right brain. I'm not quite sure that's the right way to say it, but there is two different ways that which we get information from reality. And the mechanism that we use is one that is very powerful, but at the same time, the way it functions is to divide and fracture the world into pieces. And that's what we sort of call the rational mind. And what it does, it takes things, it puts them apart and compares them. And that's a very powerful and useful tool. But we've come to the point where we are saying that that tool is the only method of connecting with reality. And by its nature, what it does is it fragments things. It takes things, it takes A, B, it splits them apart and it compares them. Which one's bigger, which one's smaller, which one's lighter, which one's brighter. And that's a great thing. If I want to size a beam in your house and you want to know whether it's Douglas fir larch or it's an LVL or it's PSF or whatever the material may be, someone's taken that board, it's running through a machine, it's got data on its compression strength and its bending strength and all kinds of wonderful things, and I can make a rational decision and put the right size beam in your house. But if that, I mean, and again, another sort of maybe broader way of thinking about this is the difference between knowledge and wisdom. So you take a society where the only method that we will accept as a way of gaining access to reality is one that splits things into pieces, it disconnects things. So in a sense, sort of the foundation of the issue and this angst that you mentioned that we've all sort of felt is that this disconnection from reality is because the way we perceive reality is by breaking those bonds and splitting things into pieces. And we think that if we break the piece small enough, we're going to get down to some sort of ultimate reality that's now going to give us the answer to everything. So the idea, the root cause of the universe, when in fact, perception of reality comes from putting everything back together. So in a sense, what we've done now, we've broken the world into a million pieces, and now we have to try and put it back together, which I would call sort of ecological thinking or direct perception. And that is a faculty and an ability that we all have that we sort of are denying and exists, and we're using a part of our consciousness that does the opposite, that disconnects us. And so if there's anything I can say about 21st century, it's really about disconnection from reality. And the more disconnected from reality you become, the more fearful you become. And the Eastern, which has been a great model for me, has a very nice and concise way of describing us. If we have time, we can get into that a little bit. But until we shift out of that mechanism where we accept only the rational mind as our only bridge to reality, we're going to continue to create the same kind of havoc and problems that we've been seeing on and on. I mean, we see this thing where, you know, yogurt is bad for you. No, yogurt's a cure to all things. You know, spinach is good for you. No, it causes cancer. You know, this diet, this is the diet of the moment. No, that doesn't work. We'll go to the other diet. This is the product of that kind of thinking that fractures everything into a million pieces, and it continues, and this is a very, probably not time to get into this in all the detail we would need to, but that thinking is what creates that kind of, you know, flip-flopping from one, you know, one silver bullet to the next. And until we can get out of that mode and accept the other part of our consciousness that is able to bridge and connect us back to reality again, it's going to be the same kind of chaos. And again, if we use that same kind of consciousness, even with the right information, we're going to continue to create this outward chaos that we're seeing around us forever until we make that change.
So let me chase that down a little further, because there's a very important set of points in there. So you said, well, maybe about the time of the Greeks. So we went down this reductionist left brain path, and we've chased that pretty far. And so as we've gone down that reductionist path, you know, we went through all of Newtonian physics, and we discovered that, in fact, there wasn't just earth, air, fire, and water. There were these things called molecules. Hey, wait, there's these things called atoms. Hey, wait, they have these nuclei, protons, and neutrons with electrons around them. So we defined reality. But then as we burrowed further, a strange thing happened. We got into the idea that once you go down a little bit further into the subatomic space, Nothing's Newtonian anymore. There are no such things as particles. Everything is an energetic form with a wave function and a set of probabilities around it. And that's all we can say, right? We went quantum on the whole thing.
Right.
And so science maybe should be leading us all. Once we went down the science hole, it's a torus. It brought us right back to the surface again and says, hey, guess what? You can't possibly know everything by breaking this all apart, because once you've broken it apart far enough, it literally becomes unknowable. And it's just probabilities at this point. But the hubris of the left brain is that you can know it all. And I run into this all the time where people say, if we create those sorts of problems, we'll fix them. I have this vision that nature is so complex that we still can't begin to understand what's happening in a teaspoonful of fertile soil, let alone what's happening across our gut biome, let alone what happens across an entire integrated ecosystem. It's beyond our rational brain. It's beyond any supercomputer to understand. But there is a knowing that we can interact with those ecosystems in very positive and enhancing, abundance-enhancing ways, but it's not through the reductionist path. So what do you say to this idea that this rational side of our mind actually is a rationalizing thing, and it's rationalized our approach by saying, you know what? All we have to do is get a little better at this, and we got it nailed. We're just a little more technology, and we're there. You know, then we'll have it.
Exactly.
Does that exhaust itself, or are people going to cling to that right to the point where it becomes completely obvious that was a broken model?
Well, I think, I mean, the beauty of it all is, and I've said this, and people, I don't know if people think I'm crazy, but the world is perfect in that every off-course action has a corresponding reaction that brings you back to the center again. So the thing has to self-correct because the world is perfect in itself. And all these sort of, I like to think of these sort of perceptions as like, if you think of reality as a loaf of bread, all these perceptions, whether you're an agnostic or you're religious or you're a scientist or whatever it is, to me is a slice through this loaf and you look at that face, and that what you're describing is completely accurate. It's like the old tale about the wise man and the elephant. Mm-hmm. Each one of their perceptions is exactly accurate, and they're all true, but they don't get the point because they're not seeing the whole. And the greatest, you know, sort of sin, which is actually an archery term for being off target, is when the part tries to become the whole. And the mind is not the seat of consciousness. And again, this can get very abstract and difficult to deal with, but the mind, in a sense, is a processor of consciousness, but not consciousness itself. And when you try and take the mind, when the part tries to become the whole, that's when things get distorted and out of shape. So what we've done is we're saying this, as you put so well, I mean, you know, the unknowing, the incapability of the rational mind to perceive reality directly, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, the particle wave theory of light, and all kinds of amazing things that sort of, you said, it brought us back full circle to realize the limitations of the rational mind. The rational mind only processes consciousness. And I think the Hindus have done a great job of describing how that actually exists. And they describe seven centers or chakras. But what the mind does, it processes where your consciousness is in your body, in your being. So if you're in the fear center, everything you see and perceive is perceived through that center. So everything becomes a life and death experience. And so someone in a gas line who gets cut off and has to wait an extra half hour, you know, you hear these stories, someone getting out a gun and shooting somebody. Well, that person is processing the reality through their fear center, where everything becomes a life and death situation. So there is a possibility of trans. So again, if you're thinking of the computer of the mind as the seat of consciousness, then you're denying the ability to perceive reality directly, because it only is a mechanism that processes consciousness, not the seat of it itself. Is that too abstract? Or?
Well, not for me, but I've been wrestling with these things for a while. And the first piece, and I got this from Eckhart Tolle after listening many, many times to A New Earth, a book on tape. It was very good for me. And what he's talking about there is that the mind identification, this thing called ego, which is my tool, which is just on all the time. It's just talking to me all the time. It's parsing things. Right. It's organizing, weighing, sorting. You know, there's an attractive person. That's not. I like this person. I don't like that person. This is a good experience. Right. That's a bad one. It's doing all that stuff for me. And I've been trained in that, because that's all of my Western culture is like, that's the thing. That's the thing you want. We're going to put you to school for it, and you're going to work that tool. So it became an awesome tool. Right. And it was only much later I realized that I have a consciousness that's separate from that tool, from that chattering box, and that consciousness is it's actually exists throughout me. in a way. And so yes, if I have a certain body of an orientation that I'm coming through, that experience is my reality. So you mentioned the fear center. You know, an example I've talked about before is on the site is, you know, imagine you're walking down the street and you're having a perfectly lovely day and somebody walks by you and they're just laughing. And you have a framework that says it's paranoid. Oh my God, they were laughing at me. Oh my God, this person just laughed at me. My day is ruined. How did they see through this veil of mine? Oh my God, and your day is crushed and you'll process that and maybe chew on it for the next 48 hours till it begins to dim. And it was a really transformative bad experience. And somebody else has that same experience walking by that laughing person, but their view is that this person was sharing happiness and that they just got a dose of happiness and they walk off and they have 5 minutes of bliss from that and that's the end of the experience for them. Same experience, two entirely different experiences with it. And that's just showing that that mind tool that connected through our framing, that does define our experience 100% completely.
Right.
We'll call it reality. That was truth. For both those people, those were true experiences. It was true.
Absolutely. Yeah, and so if we then continue to identify with the chattering mind, as it were, then what the saddest thing about that all is it denies you a direct connection with reality, which can occur through the intuitive mind, because the chattering mind, which is again the thing that divides and as its very method separates things into pieces and separates us, disconnects us from each other. Once that portion of the mind finds its rightful place in our general consciousness, then the intuitive mind, which can connect directly, can separate between the small I of ourselves, individual ego, and the big I of the universe, then direct connection becomes possible. And so all these sort of the craziness that, you know, like you said, the people you talk to who just, you can talk yourself blue in the face and they're so connected to a belief system because they're holding on to all these individual separate pieces of their individual egos, then no connection becomes possible. But once the mind can stop and take its rightful place and we can come in direct contact with reality, then everything shifts. And to me, then all these other problems that we're trying to solve can be solved so quickly. It's like, as I say, the problem is enormous, but it's very small at the same time, because it takes such a small shift within each one of us to transform ourselves in a way that we can begin to solve these problems in a rational way, rather than applying the same old consciousness, which sort of just continues to multiply under the whole problem of unintended consequences, sort of a story of the century, huh?
Yeah, and I'm going to harken back to this idea where you said the world is perfect, which I hold. And to get there, though, a little circuitous as always. What I'm thinking about in relation to what you just said, I believe it was in Macbeth, Shakespeare wrote, "There is nothing ever good or bad, but thinking makes it so." Which is this idea that the thinking is what attaches either good or bad to it, right? And so this was a big part of my identification for a long time, so I get it, right? So like you make a winning stock trade and that's great and you're elated, and then you make a bad one and that's crushing and it's awful. And what I now know is that it's just my frame of reference whether I decide to call something good or bad. And I've started to really lose that architecture in my daily life. So people often say, oh, you know, wouldn't you just want joy and happiness and all that? And I say, no, because one of my beliefs about my culture is that it's asking us to live in a very narrow band of existence. Hey, are you too happy? We got a pill for that. Ooh, are you too sad? Got a pill for that. Here are the three things you can talk about at a social gathering, right? It's this little thin little band, like don't get too high, don't get too low, stay on the reservation, and it's a tiny one, right? And that's my experience with it. And now what I want is I understand that life is all about these paradoxes. Sun Tzu said, if you really want to live, you have to embrace death, meaning the paradox that you can't really live until you're comfortable with death, right? And I now know that people say, oh, I want to love more deeply. I now know that the paradox that comes with that is my capacity to love is directly connected to the amount of grief that I am capable of holding.
Right. That's just exactly where I wanted to go to next, which is amazing. It really, our ticket in is our ability to suffer. And it's funny that Buddhists say that life is suffering. Mm-hmm. And it's not, I think we sort of understand that backwards, because the suffering comes between the perfection of the world that's out there and the state in which we are in, and able to live with the difference between where we are and what our capabilities and possibilities are. So often what we do is, there's some negative quality within ourselves. We're not capable of loving the way we are. Maybe we feel we're a little too greedy, or maybe we feel like whatever the typical issue may be, that we then, rather than accept that state and allow ourselves to stay there in that conflict, in that place where we're uncomfortable, and experience that suffering and pain, and allow ourselves to transform it, we tend to justify it. Well, you know, if I didn't do it, someone else would do it. Or, you know, I'm better than the guy next door, so it's really okay. So if we can find that place, and again, it all starts with, again, the foundation of being able to love ourselves, so we're able to accept that pain. But that pain is our ticket in. That's our ticket into reality. That's our ticket to experience real spiritual growth. Allowing ourselves to allow, and so like you said, in so many ways, allowing ourselves to accept all those dichotomies. Because in a sense, once we name something, once we say, okay, I've got a solution to that problem, then the learning stops. Because we are no longer dynamically alive, but we sort of put it in a box to find it. And based on the limitations of our current consciousness, it really isn't possible to resolve the things at that level. Because that understanding, I find, always comes with an annihilation of opposites, where things that apparently seem to be in conflict suddenly disappear. And that's sort of that where the peace resides, where you come in direct contact with reality. It's allowing ourselves, as you said, it's the pain is the ticket in. It's the ability to suffer is our ability to love. And once the two sort of travel together, they're both sides of the same coin. And once you get to that place, then you are able to see reality directly. And when you're in contact with reality, the power of the love and the power of reality is simply overwhelming and sort of makes the struggle worth it. There's a sort of a sweetness to suffering that it's hard to describe. I'm sure we've all experienced that at some level or another. But it's that where real love comes from, love that has no I attached to it, where there's nothing in for me, there's no ulterior motive. You're there just as a pure essence of being, and the self is gone. And when the self is gone, that allows you to connect to the other, allows you to connect to the people you love, allows you to connect to, you can say, I love my country. You can say, I love this person, because it's no longer attached to the self. And when the self is gone, then you can connect to reality, and then, you know, like I said in one of the earlier podcasts, the inane chatter of the ego mind sort of becomes absurd, and you realize the lack of reality to it in a way.
I agree with all of that, and let me see if I can put one spin on this. It harkens back to this idea that nothing is ever good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And it's around, this was a really important part of my own development, what you're describing here. Let me talk around the word suffering, because to me, I have a judgment around suffering, and I would say, oh, that's bad. In fact, somebody really, I got one of those great transmissions, I love these, where somebody says one thing to you, and it like shifts you. Like, I love those moments. And they said,
right,
pain is real, suffering is optional. And what I took from that is that sometimes, you know, you have real pain, real physical pain, toothache, or there's real physical pain, there can be heartbreak, which has a physical component. That's real. The suffering is the optional part. And so those moments of intensity you're talking about, like where it's grief, when I feel those now, I no longer say to myself, this is a bad experience, or I'm gonna experience this so that dot 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 I can grow more, or I'm not even saying that I want to really experience this so it'll move through quickly. I don't have any attachment to that anymore. I just simply notice it, and I actually like the intensity now of whatever I'm experiencing, whether it's joy or if there's an opposite to that. I actually revel in that, because now it feels more like I'm actually engaging in life as I was designed to, that I'm here to,
right,
like my capacity to experience more and more intensity is now, there's a little goal, I got some ego wrapped in it, I like it. It feels right to me in a sort of a DNA blueprint. I can't even explain it. It's like, you know, I can just
right,
say, this
right,
feels human and normal. And why was I not, nobody talked to me about this when I was growing up. Nobody.
Yeah, it is amazing how little our inner development and inner self is sort of been neglected. And I think in some ways, the sort of the Gnostic traditions behind all the major religious traditions in the West have sort of been lost. And so we've sort of been left with sort of these outward shells, where the sort of the vital life force behind this sort of deeper inner spiritual training is sort of almost, it's sort of been neglected in a way. And how little of that gets transmitted, and I think in some ways it was transmitted through families, generation to generation. Our culture has been so destroyed by a whole variety of forces that all those sort of normal transmissive forces that sort of allowed that kind of information to be transmitted has sort of been lost. And our cultural pieces that were sort of the residual vessels of that kind of stuff has sort of been lost as well. So now we're sort of left to sort of rebuild and rediscover this on its own. which is an amazing, it's amazing to watch it all happen, because my sense is it's almost like this energy is like hitting the planet right now, and it's all, and maybe it is, it's sort of what maybe what the Hindus call creative destruction, where all the old systems and structures, cultural structures that were sort of decaying and then become ossified, were now sort of being swept all away and allowing this new thing to come into place, where the, in order for birth to occur, you have to have the death and decay of the old systems first, which creates the space for the new to come into existence. So even in this sort of negativity, there always is the creation of possibilities that's allowing us to transform ourselves.
Yeah. Now, let me tell you, you and I are of an age, and let me tell you that not everybody, but more and more when I encounter young people, so to me, this is now anybody under the age of 30, but sort of in that 30 zone and under, I'm encountering more and more people who, including my own children, who have really much more elegantly advanced inner tracking mechanisms, and they've done personal work, and these are not new concepts to them, and they've looked into this future that you and I talk about, that we talk about on Peak Prosperity, and they flat out largely said no thanks. You know, they're not, they can see that this is a destructive direction to go. They're not engaged with it. And what's interesting to me is that we really need to start to figure out how to get the we in this story again, because there's this generational gap that started to appear. Not everywhere, but it's starting to appear.
Right.
But it only makes sense, right? Because if you're asking young people to live into a narrative that they frankly are going to call, excuse my French, bullshit on, well, guess what? You know, don't be too surprised when they don't show up all excited for that party when you ask them to step into it. And so it feels to me like this layer of this consciousness and this conversation that you and I are having, we really, really, really have to have this open dialogue about what's really important, what it really means to be alive, the kind of world that we're creating for ourselves. Because, and I'll be honest with you, I have a design. I have some attachment to outcome. I'd really rather not enter that world where there's 10 billion people on the face of the planet and we're all eating seaweed.
Right.
You know, and there's no other animals left alive. I don't want to go there. Personally, I have a different future that I could imagine where we all get to live in abundance.
Right.
But where do we start? Like, you and I are having this conversation, but like, how do you think we really begin to, what more can we do to make this an okay and safe conversation to have more widely?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's something I think we all struggle with. And you know, part of, you know, what you've done by creating the website and allowing people to connect, to me, there's everything, and we have to be aware of this. There's always a sort of a dark side and a light side, all kinds of technology. In a sense, what I really feel good about on the technological side is the ability of what's happening with the communication possibilities. The automation side is a little scary in some ways, because in a sense, what we need to do is connect consciousness to reality. And when you automate things, you're pulling consciousness out and away from the productive activities that human beings are engaged in on a regular basis. So think about the flash crashes on Wall Street. So here's something that you're now sort of creating these dark pools where machines are running reality, and the human consciousness is sort of pulled from sort of important parts of our whole financial system. On the other hand, you know, the ability of, you know, us to connect on through the internet with, you know, it, even in my professions, like, if you haven't got a better answer than someone can Google on the internet in 5 minutes, then you better start looking for another job. And I think that goes across the boards. I mean, the level of information that's available to us is really astounding. You'd have to live in the Library of Congress 30 years ago in order to have this kind of access to information and access to other cultures and other peoples and ideas and thoughts. And it's just, it's amazing. And that to me is where sort of the most hope for me comes from. And I think, again, the idea of the world being perfect, it is self-correcting, that each of these actions, I don't think we're going to get to a, you know, a population level where, you know, I don't know, but I think that each and one of our actions and this offness that our generation have sort of, well, the other thing I can think about is if things could have happened any other way, they would have. And that each one of these steps is sort of difficult and painful as they are part of the necessary evolution of us both individually and as a culture and as a race to get to the place where we need to be. And I sort of think of evolution not as a straight line, but sort of follows a form of our DNA, a helix. So from one point of view, it looks like we're going in circles, but from the right perspective, actually, we are moving in a direction. So we may be returning back to a point where we perceive that we were before, but it's at one level, it's been transformed by processing through all those portions of reality. It's like each and every, like when Jesus said, no law, the letter will be overturned. We have to process through each piece, and there's no shortcuts. We have to go through it all. But that whole process and everything that's occurring in the world today is part of that process of our healing the darkness, owning the darkness, and then allowing ourselves to transform the darkness into light. And to me, it's just about really the best thing we can do is live close to our authentic selves and communicate to everyone around us what we're going through honestly and authentically. And that is really an amazing and transformative process. I think the other part of it is believing and loving ourselves. And when we act authentically and not by following, not becoming a secondhand person, looking for the expert to then walk in their shoes, but internalizing all the things that are coming at us, you know, opening up and addressing them authentically and telling and talking to our friends and loved ones about it, how we feel authentically, our ability to act authentically is transformative, not only of ourselves, but to everyone we come in contact with. And I think it's going to just explode. I think we're at a point where all of a sudden, all this stuff is going to be, people are going to realize this is just completely insane. What the hell are we thinking? I mean, thinking of a guy who's got to own a 10,000 square foot house. I mean, how much room does the physical body need? How many beds do you need? What is that really all about? Why is that needed? What is that? I think once we see that, like all of us are coming to those realizations, what is that really about? Why do we need this stuff? And we're going to find the answers are really about cultural expectations, have nothing to do with our internal happiness, what we really need. So again, we can be very happy with a lot less than we're using right now. It's like Rob Hopkins, you know, it's the other reality is so much better. He was an environmental campaigner who talked about, you know, oh, the world's going to end. You got to change. The world's going to end. And then he realized that just didn't work. This alternative reality is so much better. It's so much healthier, saner, happier way of being that when people realize there's another alternative out there, I think the old system is going to, you know, flatten itself in a very short period of time.
And that's where I attach what I'm seeing shifting in young people is that they've lost their connection to the old narrative because it frankly is a bum deal for them. And so the old narrative just, it's going to lose its energy at some point anyway, as we go towards that. And so when this whole idea that, you know, here's my new understanding is that the baseline for humans, you take our DNA and you give us our basic needs. Our baseline is happiness, joy, and health. Those are our baselines, but we've got that all upside down. People now have this view that, oh, health is something that you have to work for. You got to go to the gym, maybe get a trainer, get a special diet, because we've created a system of unhealth for ourselves so that our new baseline is unhealthy. So people have to seek what I consider to be baseline. Our bodies heal themselves. It's magnificent, right? And happiness should be our baseline, but we've sold ourselves this idea that happiness comes from having that 10,000 square foot house or getting this next thing, right? And ask anybody on their deathbed how much happiness that bought, and they'll say practically none. If it might actually made me unhappy. And it was George Carlin said, trying to achieve happiness by buying stuff is like trying to solve hunger by taping sandwiches to your body. Right? So he got it in a single line, right? So so really this is like this stuff that you and I are talking about is we say, okay, the world around us, if we begin to let it in and really understand it as we see it, it's starting to say things to us. And those things might include the idea that we're not actually, we don't have the number one lifestyle in the world, and that it's not perfect, and that there could be more balance, and that this thing we're all trying to achieve through the outside by buying houses and cars and other that was actually something that you can't achieve from the outside, can only achieve inside, and that once I agree with this transmission mechanism, because I've had this personal experience of people saying that because of my presence, I've shifted them. And I haven't done anything. I haven't tried to shift them. I didn't have any plan. I wasn't trying to be a spiritual, nothing or other. But that I'm carrying a frequency inside myself which says that I am very happy and very content with where I've ended up. And I got here, I got to admit, Andrew, because I started down a path of fear and said, whoa, look at all this stuff I got to avoid. But now that I got here, I would run towards it willingly. If you took it all away again, I would get back here much more rapidly because I go, that's a better place to be. That's a better place
absolutely.
To be. And I, you know, in I guess we're coming up on our time here, but in closing, for me, that process started with a moment of personal pain, emotional pain. And I experienced that at the time and said, this is awful, poor suffering me. And now I know that was actually my call to, that was my invitation to go on a journey. And so Now I would not pass that up. At the time I was like, what could I do to avoid this? And I tried everything, but now I would look back and go, oh no, that was the moment it all started. That was awesome. That was good stuff. So this path has some intensity on it, but I no longer say it's good or bad. I just say, if you really want to step into a truer, authentic self, where I find greater contentment and happiness, and other people seem to as well, that involves a path that has some intensity on it for a lot of people. But that intensity isn't bad. It just is. It's just part of life.
I think what you said is so important, and that's such a key point, in that you feel you have to do something, you realize just by the place that you are shifts people around you. It's such an important point. You don't have to go out and solve anybody else's problems. You don't have to tell them what to do or how to be. That by being in that place yourself brings that part of other people forward and allows them to experience what you're experiencing. So by, you know, each of us are part of this greater consciousness, and by each of us fulfilling ourselves and being present for other people is really transformative. You don't have to go out and fix somebody else. You don't have to solve their problems. But by just being present and listening to another person, the power of that, to really listen not with your own craziness and your own agenda, your own ideas, but to listen authentically and openly to another person is where the transformation can occur. And then all this ideas like, well, they have a different religion, they have a different way of thinking and seeing the world, all that stuff sort of falls by the wayside organically and naturally as we begin to connect with each other really in an authentic and real way.
Absolutely. I think of that as like that's the ultimate gift economy, because the truth was I got that transmission from somebody else before me, and I will pass that on to other people, and that's the way it spreads. It's just, and it's not anything special. It's everybody's got the capability. It's just a thing. It's what humans do. It's actually part of our blueprint, and it's a other cultures have recognized that for a long time. I'm very hopeful and excited to see that my own culture is starting to wake up to this. We're seeing little signs, you know, mindfulness in the CEO room is starting, you know, we're yoga here and better eating there. And so people are starting to get to this idea that yeah, there's more to life than we can just get to through our left brain. That's the easiest way to put it.
it is sort of interesting. And in a way, it's sort of like you look at when sort of different cultures sort of become in contact with another, like when Eastern culture became in contact with the West. Well, now sort of yoga has turned into an exercise craze. They've sort of taken it and distorted it, but at the same time, that's sort of the negative side of it, but at the same time, the positive side, there was this shift when people began to realize that the material or the outside world is not where happiness resides, but there's something internal. There is an inner journey that can sort of transform ourselves, that takes us away from thinking that the answers are all outside of ourselves, that buying the next thing or owning the next piece of property or whatever it may be that we've quickly come attached to is sort of not the way to happiness. But as each one of these sort of waves sort of washes through the culture, again, they do get diluted in a way that we can think of as being negative, but at the same time, I think each little increment sort of transforms our culture in a way that takes it in a more positive direction.
Yeah, and let me go one step higher than that. For me, is this idea that I'm very happy with the personal progression I get out of this line of inquiry and wrestling with these things, thinking about them, and you know, in that spiral way, you know, slowly getting, even as I re-experience things, slowly seeming to make some progress, is this idea that this thing we're talking about to me actually feels like a worthy pursuit to really do as much as I can in this pass-through life to really advance myself and open myself up. That feels worthy as a human. It was a recent interview. Somebody asked me, you know, classic question, like, if you could have three people for dinner, who, you know? And I said, oh, it's Carl Jung, it's Albert Einstein and Herbie Hancock. You know, why an astrophysicist, a psychoanalyst, and a jazz musician? And the answer was because in their memoirs, each one of them expressed some idea which went like this. People think I had these great ideas, but it wasn't me. I just opened myself up and creativity flowed through me. I was a vessel. They all said that. So
right.
People who I really admire, who are really deeply creative, who really change the course of things for humans because of what they produce in life, many of them come to this idea that, oh yeah, I was in touch with this extraordinary, amazing source of creation, and I'm just the conduit for that. I wanted to ask them, what are your practices? How would you, you know, how did that come to be? And this is the most important thing I've learned now. First part of my life was about acquiring information and skills. This part of my life is about removing those things that prevent me from accessing that source of creativity. It's about losing stuff, not gaining. I don't need any new skills.
Right. No.
I just need to lose those masks, those barriers that even within myself prevent me from accessing what I think I'm capable of. And that feels like a worthy, that's a challenge that I'm really intrigued by.
Yes, and that's very well said, and that's a great next sort of step. And that it's really, and that it sort of goes to the whole idea that even our own thoughts, we sort of perceive ourselves as a source of many things. And even our thoughts are, I sort of like to think of them, there is only one creator in a sense, and that even our thoughts is like finding shells on a beach. And then we find the shell and said, oh, I found the shell. This is my thought. This is my idea. And we become attached. In reality, this is all just us experiencing reality. And then once we begin to identify, you begin to lock down and close your ability to perceive reality directly, to come in contact, as you say, with that creative, loving, powerful force that animates all of life. So it's the idea of the sort of the greedy, small self that wants to hold on to things, that doesn't trust, that lives in fear, that is unable to let go and sort of allow the energy to flow through us as a conduit for the greater sort of reality that we're all in contact with. And again, that still goes back to the same idea of becoming attached to the rational mind and rejecting the intuitive mind and now allowing ourselves to experience things directly. And for me, I mean, I came through, again, a challenging life in a lot of ways, and that part of what allowed me to grow as a person was the idea of non-attachment. The idea that this behavior, this activity, whatever it may be that we're currently experiencing is not who we are in the depths of ourselves, but in allowing ourselves to experience the difference between what we can be, what our potential is, and where we are currently without judgment, and allowing to sort of love and accept ourselves, which is, to me, what allows us to transform ourselves and allow us to come directly in contact with that creative force that you just talked about so eloquently. So it's really about non-identification, not defending the self, but allowing ourselves to having, and again, it comes to sort of loving ourselves and allowing ourselves to experience reality without judgment. Because oftentimes, the pain of, oh, I should have done that right. And this sort of brings up an interesting story about someone who was in a very difficult life. And then, too, the judgments we have about people. And she got into a place where she was addicted to drugs for a while. And in our sort of negative cultural narrative, oh, you're a bad person, you were taking drugs and whatnot. And she said that, thank God those drugs were there for me at that point in time, because that's what I needed. I was in so much pain, I needed to self-medicate myself at that point in time. So to let go of the negative judgments about the self, because when you're becoming in a very negative place where you're judging the self, you don't get the ability to learn from the experience, because there's so much, like you said, pain, the suffering is optional, but pain is not. If you're able to let go of the judgment about what you're experiencing and love the self as you're going through this process, that allows you to transform yourself, because you're not identifying with those pieces and accepting yourself as, you know, the process that you need to go through to get to where you need to be. And it's not too bad. You know, this is not unfortunate. This is what's happening is not bad. This is a necessary part of the transformation that we need to go through to get to this other place where we can really be authentic and loving and true to each other. And it's just part of the process. And once we accept the fact that this is not, you know, or why does this have to happen? Why are we going through this? Why is the banks doing it? Whatever our particular bugaboo may be at the moment, it is not to condone it or to say it's okay. And I think that's the difficulty that most people have, but they're saying by accepting and forgiving it, you're condoning it. But that's a totally different kind of place. If you're able to accept and love through the process of this pain and realize it's not condoning it, it allows us to learn and move forward and heal all those things that need healing in our world right now.
Oh, that's all so very well said. And if it all boils down, it begins by fully accepting and loving ourselves. And then from that, everything else flows. So we've been talking with our philosopher in residence, Andrew, also known as Treebeard. So Treebeard, thank you so much for your time today. And I know we're going to have to continue this conversation because obviously we just scratched the surface. So
absolutely. No, it's great fun.
It's great fun for me too. And by the way, this was my own personal moment of vulnerability because I've been holding and thinking these things for a long time. So I've gotten to the point now where I'm just like, you know what? It's time to just let this stuff out and see what happens. And some will resonate with it, some won't. So to anybody listening, hope you're taking what you can from this. And if it works for you, great. And if it doesn't, that's fine too. Not trying to convince anybody of anything, just letting some stories out about what's been true for me. So, Andrew, thanks again.
Well, congratulations. Great. Thanks, Chris.